Hello and welcome to the Palliative Care Journal Watch podcast by Pallium Canada for March 2024, where our panel of palliative care experts keep you informed of the latest peer-reviewed palliative care literature. Our hosts, Dr. Leonie Herks and Dr. Sharon Watanabe, join us for the 12th episode of the Palliative Care Journal Watch. If you'd like to access accompanying slides and links to the articles discussed in today's podcast, visit the link in the episode notes. This podcast is a collaboration between Pallium Canada and the divisions of palliative care at Queen's University and McMaster University. It is a part of the Palliative Care Echo Project, which aims to support continuous professional development among healthcare providers across Canada who care for patients with life-limiting illness. The Palliative Care Echo Project is supported by financial contributions from Health Canada. However, the views expressed in today's episode do not necessarily represent the views of Health Canada. With no further ado, it's time for the Journal Watch.
Welcome, everybody, to our 12th session of Journal Watch. My name is Dr. Leonie Herks, and today we'll be joined by our co-host, Dr. Sharon Watanabe, and guest panelist, Dr. Braden DeBroni. The Palliative Care Journal Watch is a regular series of webinars that keeps you up to date on the latest peer-reviewed palliative care literature. This program is led by experts from several divisions of palliative care and palliative care medicine across Canada and internationally. Our team of academic clinicians is on the lookout. We regularly monitor over 30 journals and highlight papers that have the potential to challenge us to think differently about a topic or confirm our current practices in palliative care. The Palliative Care Journal Watch program is part of the Palliative Care Echo Project, which is supported with a financial contribution from Health Canada. This project aims to cultivate communities of practice and establish continuous professional development amongst healthcare professionals across Canada who care for patients with a life-limiting illness. In terms of what to expect from today's session, we will highlight and discuss our top four article selections and provide a list of honorable mentions at the end. These honorable mentions are articles that we thought were noteworthy, but due to time constraints, we aren't able to discuss them with you today. The recording of each webinar, the accompanying slides, and links to the articles covered will also be available on our website. This is a 1 credit per hour group learning program that has been certified by the College of Family Physicians of Canada for up to 8 Main Pro Plus credits. Each 1 hour session is worth 1 Main Pro credit. I'm Leonie Herks, and I'll be co-hosting today's session. I am the Section Chief of Pediatric Palliative Medicine for Alberta Health Services, Calgary Zone, the Director of Rotary Flames House, Children's Hospice and Palliative Care Services, and a clinical professor at the Cumming School of Medicine. I'd like Dr. Sharon Watanabe and then Dr. Braden DeBroni to introduce themselves.
Hello, I'm Sharon Watanabe. I'm a palliative care physician based at the Cross Cancer Institute in Edmonton, and I also am on faculty with the Division of Palliative Care Medicine in the Faculty of Medicine and Dentistry at the University of Alberta.
Hi, I'm Braden DeBroni. I'm a palliative care physician with the WRHA palliative care program in Winnipeg, Manitoba. I finished up a plus 1 year of training in palliative medicine in 2020 after doing a family medicine background. So I work with the academic department with the University of Manitoba for palliative medicine.
Great. And we're excited to have Braden here today. He's one that we've had the University of Manitoba recently join us as the contributing division. So it's great to have you joined for your first Journal Watch today, Braden. In terms of disclosures, Pallium Canada is a not-for-profit organization that has received funding from Health Canada. Aside from the funding from Health Canada, Pallium also generates funds through its sales of the Pallium Pocketbook and course registration fees. I receive a stipend from Pallium Canada for research work on the Canadian Atlas of Palliative Care, and Dr. Sharon Watanabe and Dr. Braden DeBroni have no conflicts of interest to declare. All right, so let's get to it. Today, we have 4 featured articles across a very interesting spectrum of palliative care interests. So the first one is looking at anxiety and depression in metastatic cancer, a critical review of negative impacts on advanced care planning and end-of-life decision-making with some practical recommendations. Next, we're going to talk about acute palliative care units, a scoping review done by Eduardo Barrera. Thirdly, we're going to talk about the impact of dosing of a very common medication we use across palliative care, dexamethasone, and look at corticosteroid-related adverse events. And lastly, we're going to have a very interesting discussion about machine learning in allocating palliative care consultations during cancer treatment. So we'll get right to it. Over to Dr. Watanabe.
All right, so I get to lead us off with this study from a group of researchers in Colorado looking at the impact of anxiety and depression in the context of metastatic cancer on decision making, advanced care planning, and associated with some practical recommendations. So the premise for this paper is that anxiety and depression are highly prevalent in patients with advanced cancer and their caregivers. Some studies suggest that up to one-third of patients with advanced cancer and up to a half of their caregivers have clinically significant anxiety and depression. And this has a potential to have an impact on advanced care planning and end-of-life decision-making. So the goal of these researchers was to understand the impacts of anxiety and depression on advanced care planning and end-of-life decision-making in the context of advanced cancer. So the methodology that they use was what's called a critical review framework. So what these authors realized is that the number of studies looking at the association between anxiety and depression on advanced care planning and end-of-life decision-making is at the moment quite limited. So they would need to actually look at the broader literature on the impact of anxiety and depression on decision-making in general, and then looking at the association with decision-making in a general healthcare context, and then honing down to those smaller number of papers looking at the metastatic cancer context. Because of the small size of the literature, they could not do a systematic review or meta-analysis. For the source of the papers included in their study, they looked at three databases that span oncology, psycho-oncology, and mental health literature. And they did two separate searches. The first one was looking at conceptual or review articles on decision-making in the context of anxiety and depression, and not specifically in the healthcare context. And then in their second search, then they were trying to identify those studies that were in a healthcare context and also in that subgroup in cancer, the cancer context. By the end of their search process and filtering through the studies, they ended up with 219 separate articles. And these articles were read and analyzed by a multidisciplinary team that had relevant research and clinical experience in this area. What they found, quite a number of findings that were described in the study, will hit some of the highlights. But I think at the end of the day, the main focus is going to be on some of the tables that had some practical recommendations. And on this slide, I didn't include some of those more conceptual findings from their broader literature review. But in general, what it boils down to is when someone is anxious, they have a heightened perception of threat, and that leads to avoidant behavior. And when someone is depressed, that leads to lack of motivation in decision-making and follow-through. So it leads to inaction. So that's sort of the general concept. Next on the slide, we have the specific findings looking at the general healthcare context and the cancer-specific context. So in the general healthcare context, there are studies that show people who have a high level of anxiety will, in fact, tend to avoid having advanced care planning and end-of-life decision-making conversations. Interestingly, if they're moderately anxious, that actually motivates them to engage in this. But if they're highly anxious, it's a deterrent. And then for those persons who are depressed, they are less likely to follow through with medical recommendations, be that with medications or some health behavior or going through some diagnostic procedure. So that's the general context. And then they go into the cancer-specific studies in a bit more detail because there aren't many studies. And one consistent finding is that patients who are experiencing anxiety or depression prior to a consultation or to some sort of a treatment or procedure, there is a tendency to regret the decision after that consultation or treatment or procedure. And also they have a sense of dissatisfaction, of being feeling unsupported or inadequately informed in their decision making. Now, for caregivers, there was one study in the ICU context where caregivers who were anxious or depressed had a preference for passive decision making. But this was caregivers, and not all the patients involved had cancer. Other studies have looked at the impact of death anxiety, so worrying about death, on advanced care planning and end of life decision making, and show that patients with death anxiety do have lower rates of advanced directive completion or discussion of their end of life wishes. And on top of that, they're more likely to have a discordance between their preferences for care and what they actually receive. And then finally, anxiety does have an impact on patient healthcare provider communication, leading to lower levels of trust in their physicians, less comprehension of the information, and it can be bi-directional as well. If patients are anxious and reluctant to discuss these issues, and the physicians themselves may be reluctant to have that communication. So those were their findings. So in their discussion, what they say that their study does confirm that anxiety and depression can lead to less engagement and satisfaction with advanced care planning, cancer treatment, and end-of-life decisions. And so they advocate for, in the moment, using some strategies to shift that negative emotional cognitive state of the patient and or the caregiver before launching into that advanced care planning and end-of-life planning discussion and decision-making. So while it's still important to assess the anxiety and depression themselves and address that, sometimes you have to make a decision in the moment, and that doesn't allow you time to comprehensively address the person's emotional state. And so what they include in their paper are three tables that have practical recommendations and sample scripts for reducing anxiety and depression symptoms and biases. So the first table is for patients who are anxious or depressed. Second table is for those patients who have social anxiety. And then the last table is for patients who have trauma-related distress, PTSD. So the strengths is that they have done a pretty good job, I think, of summarizing quite a broad-ranging literature on anxiety and depression and decision-making. And it sounds like their team does have the appropriate experience to do the analysis. And I think that the big strength from my perspective is that they came up with these practical recommendations and a script. The limitations are that, as they stated, there are very few studies in the advanced cancer context. And in fact, many of the studies that they quoted in the cancer context were in patients with early stage disease rather than advanced disease. So there is a fair bit of extrapolation from other contexts. Nonetheless, I think that in clinical practice, I believe that we all encounter those patients who are not difficult to engage in advanced care planning and end-of-life decision-making conversations. And I certainly, in our own clinic here at the Cross Cancer Institute, we tend to get referred those patients who have more emotional or psychological distress. And some of those patients are very difficult to engage in those conversations despite repeated efforts. So I am going to myself try out some of these suggestions in the paper. So I'll leave it there and welcome discussion.
Thanks, Sharon. Yeah, and there's so much to unpack in this paper, and you hit all the highlights that I think we have time to talk about. But one thing I wondered about clarifying is they talked about patients who catastrophize. And was that in the context of high anxiety? I can't quite remember. And how does that impact any relation to, or does it relate to, like death anxiety and worrying that they're going to have like horrible, you know, symptoms that are difficult to control? And does that have any relation to desire to die? I find that quite interesting to explore further.
Right. I don't recall the authors explicitly exploring that relationship between, you know, catastrophizing and death anxiety. I wouldn't be surprised that there would be an association, but they do give, as you noted, some strategies to try to mitigate that tendency to catastrophize.
And was it the ones with high anxiety that were prone to catastrophizing? I don't know how to pronounce that word exactly, but it's a tough one.
Again, I don't recall them explicitly saying, but yes, I would say, so in our clinic, we often administer a tool to assess catastrophizing more for in the pain context. So some patients will bring a lot of emotional, psychological overlay into their pain experience. And so those you know, from my observation, tend to be patients who express more anxiety and or depression for that matter.
Yeah, thanks. Braden, if you have anything you would like to add about this paper.
I don't think that I had any particular points for this one, to be honest, but it really interesting. And I think it's something that was really important to look at further. So thank you for presenting that.
Thanks. Yeah, for me, it speaks to the importance of doing routine screening for anxiety and depression in all of our patients so that we don't miss a way that we may need to adapt our care, as this article kind of suggests and gives the practical tips and tools for to being able to better engage people and move beyond innate responses because of that overlay of anxiety and depression. So again, yeah, I really appreciate the practical tools and lots more to think about with respect to the death anxiety piece for me, for sure. Thanks, Sharon. Great. So I'm going to present the next article, which is looking at acute palliative care units, the characteristics, activities, and outcomes of those on an international level. And it's a scoping review by Sebastian Mercadante and Eduardo Barrera. And it was just published in BMJ Supportive Palliative Care in December. So by background, they look at the history of palliative care units being inpatient palliative care beds that allow palliative care specialists to treat patients with the most severe physical and psychosocial symptoms. They talk about how PCUs are lacking in most cancer hospitals and when present are predominantly hospice type beds for those approaching the end of their life. And they go through some of the history, which I'm going to get Sharon to comment on in a little bit because she works and was involved in one of those pioneering acute palliative care units, which were originally developed in the 80s and 90s to provide symptom management for cancer-related comorbidities in an acute care setting, fusing that palliative care philosophy with acute medical care and the therapies and investigations that are available in an acute medical care context to the same standards of clinical competence and administrative regulation as any other medical or surgical inpatient unit. Those early APCUs, like the one in Edmonton, the tertiary palliative care unit there that Dr. Eduardo Barrera founded, provided an inpatient palliative care program focused on intensive symptom management and resulting in improved quality of care and surprisingly reduced overall healthcare costs. I think surprisingly to some hospital administrators and to cancer care in general that they thought there might be an increase in cost to having those types of units. But overall, they note that there's a lack of information and an understanding regarding what's kind of the current state of acute palliative care units internationally. So in this scoping review, they assess the characteristics, activities, and outcomes of acute palliative care units. They used PICO framework, which stands for patient problem intervention comparing an outcome. And they used the search term acute palliative care unit through the PubMed database through till the end of August 2022. They reviewed abstracts that met the inclusion and exclusion criteria, and then additional records were retrieved by HandSearch cross-references. And they reported the data following the PRISMA preferred reporting items for systematic reviews and meta-analysis rules. So through that methodology, they found 18 studies that met the inclusion and exclusion criteria, and then they comprehensively looked through those studies to look at these parameters, reasons for the acute palliative care unit admission, referrals, discharge, destination, length of the APCU stay, changes in symptom intensity, and the mortality rate. So under the reasons for acute palliative care admission, across the international jurisdictions, most people were admitted for symptom control. There's a smaller subset of people who were admitted for cancer-related or cancer treatment-related complications, and care at the end of life accounted for less than a quarter of admissions, with a big range from kind of 5 to 21%. And of course, in our Journal Watch program today, I don't have time to go through all of the details of their findings, but really encourage you to read the paper if you're intrigued. So like in the last article, I'm just presenting kind of the high-level summary. When they looked at the admission referrals, they found that in general, patients were referred from inpatient and outpatient services, including emergency rooms, other inpatient units, including internal medicine and oncology wards, oncology clinics, and palliative care clinics. Only one study included patients directly admitted from home. And there was quite a variation, actually, of patients who were admitted from the emergency room in the Arabian countries, being higher admission rates from eMERGE, and some of the countries in North America being much lower admissions from eMERGE. So quite a spectrum. And we'll get to that in the discussion. But, you know, certainly who comes and goes from the APCUs may be directly influenced by the local resources outside of the acute care site and how patients with palliative care needs are being supported. So we'll chat about that in a bit. Discharge destinations included home, hospice, and other hospitals and long-term care. And the death rate in the acute palliative care units typically ranged from 8 to 29%. So by and large, most patients were being discharged alive to other settings of care. And except in the Arabian countries, so in Qatar and Saudi Arabia, they were 60 and 86% respectively who died there. The mean length of stay was about 6 to 10 days, except in those two Arabian countries that had significantly higher death rates, as we've discussed, where the mean length of stay was quite a bit longer at 25 to 30 days. Changes in symptom intensity were assessed across physical and psychological symptoms, and all showed significant improvement in all of the studies they reviewed from baseline to discharge from APCU. And overall, as I've mentioned earlier, the mean death rate was about 20%, except in those two countries in the Arabian states. So their key discussion points really talked about how overall, currently, APCUs, although there's a broad spectrum of units internationally, the findings were quite different from inpatient hospice type units, where patients in the APCUs were primarily admitted for cancer requiring rapid pain and symptom stabilization, often still receiving anti-cancer treatment, and that the vast majority of studies, most patients were discharged alive and they weren't functioning as a hospice type unit. They discuss how the admissions and discharges were likely dependent on those local resources. So whether or not they had home care, how long to put home care in place might delay a discharge from the APCU if they had hospices available to have an alternate destination for end-of-life care if a person was found at admission to APCU to be in a state approaching end-of-life. They talked about how APCUs have an important role in the earlier provision of palliative care alongside treatments to cure or control their cancer in particular, and that actually helps introduce the role of palliative care in that context as having, you know, much important role to play earlier in the illness trajectory and can become involved intermittently to address symptom crises. They looked at how it, over a period of 10 years from 2010 to 2020 in the United States, only a quarter of the NCI designated centers had an acute palliative care unit. And in the non-NCI, which is Centers of Excellence for Cancer Care in the US, in the ones that were not NCI designated, there was a much lower level of APCUs. But over that 10-year period, there was no increase in the number of centers that were supporting acute palliative care units, despite the quality of care and the and healthcare costs being shown to be reduced in those. So not a lack of uptake on embedding this approach of acute palliative care units within comprehensive cancer centers. And then they advocate for acute palliative care units to be embedded within all cancer centers as a complementary care being provided, not to replace hospice care and should not be become hospice care as part of the full spectrum of palliative care services being offered. They do discuss how in Saudi Arabia and Qatar, where the death rates were much higher, there were other resources that weren't as readily available, such as hospices and other places to receive care. So that would certainly come into play with the amount of folks who are admitted to end of life and provided care through to death in that region. So overall, strengths and limitations, it's a scoping review and of course only includes published data. It only included one Canadian acute care palliative care unit at the Princess Margaret Hospital in Toronto. And we know that, you know, there are a number of other acute palliative care units in Canada, including two of the pioneering units that were talked about in the introduction, the tertiary palliative care unit in Edmonton, and then the intensive palliative care unit in Calgary that was founded subsequently. Further studies are obviously needed to really understand the role of acute palliative care units. I think this article is important because it really describes the differences between PCUs in different countries and supports the value of distinguishing acute palliative care units from traditional hospice units and how they serve a complementary role in that broad spectrum of providing comprehensive cancer care in particular. It would be interesting to look at their role outside of cancer care, and that gets a bit more complicated with non-cancer care. Maybe we could talk about that with the other panelists. And then I wanted to just add some context because the Canadian Atlas of Palliative Care that Palliam Canada is leading is working right now to capture palliative care unit services across the country. And one of the indicators we're looking at is a death rate of greater than 50% as part of the definition of an acute palliative care unit. So it'll be interesting to see what role palliative care units in Canada are playing. Are they more hospice type or are they more acute palliative care unit type? Our pilot data for one region in Ontario shows that most PCUs currently are hospice type. And using the Catalonia formula for the number of palliative care beds needed per 100,000 population, it is noted that 2 of the 10 recommended palliative care beds needed per 100,000 are recommended to be inpatient palliative care units. So it would be again, interesting to think about in tertiary care centers, cancer care centers, how many APCU beds are needed. So just some thoughts that I had, and I'd love to invite Sharon and Braden to make some comments, and any of you who are joining us today to please put your questions in the Q&A. I know if you want to go first, Braden.
Yeah, no, that's a great paper. I think the part about the hospice beds and the ratio of inpatient kind of acute palliative care beds to hospice is kind of eye-opening. Here in Winnipeg, we have like 45 inpatient palliative care beds, like acute unit. And then we only have 16 hospice beds for all the whole city. So like there's like a 3-to-1, you know, ratio in favor of the acute inpatient beds, whereas you're saying it should be like 80% kind of hospice to 20% palliative, like acute bed. So it's a huge discrepancy, and it's kind of been a bit of an issue in terms of like discharge planning and finding appropriate places for patients to go. When you only have 16 beds for the whole city, there's just so many patients admitted who just really can't safely get home, and we don't know the best location for them to go. So this is like, yeah, really interesting paper and just highlights, I think, what a big discrepancy there really is.
Any thoughts, Sharon?
Yes, agreed. And actually, I had not seen those ratios of beds to population before. I think in Edmonton, we're pretty close to that. Like we have 20 for a population about 1 million. We have 20 acute inpatient palliative care beds and about 85 hospice, I think. But we still find we're short of hospice beds, that is the perception at least. And yeah, the other thing I wondered about reading this paper, which it didn't look at, was staffing. And I know the Canadian Society of Palliative Care Physicians has looked at staffing for different palliative care teams or units. And I wondered what your thoughts are on would be optimal staffing.
Exactly. So as part of the staffing model, we did a review of international literature to try to understand what the model would look like in acute palliative care units. And there is no guiding literature at all. So we recommended that it would be more in keeping with what you would do for another acute medical care unit in terms of the nursing staffing. And it should actually be weighted based on patient complexity, right? As we all know, when we get patients that come to this type of acute palliative care unit, their total symptomatology and that total pain, total suffering is often very much at the forefront. That's why their symptoms are so difficult to control and they may need APCU in the first place. And so they do take somewhat a time-intensive care. So a typical like 1-to-4 acute care nursing ratio would not necessarily work because it may be that one patient actually in some situations needs 1-to-1 nursing because of their symptom crisis. So I think we need to look at building a ratio of at least from a nursing, like based on care intensity, as opposed to numbers of patients to staffing. And, you know, it certainly looked at from a physician perspective that it was more like 1 to 6 to 10 patients per physician. So for a 20 bed unit, I would, you know, our paper would suggest that we would need at least 2 physicians. Of course, in the context of an interprofessional team, which we know is required to provide holistic person-centered care, especially in an APCU context to address all of those symptoms. But those are just some initial thoughts. We do talk about that a little bit in the paper that's in the Journal of Palliative Medicine for those who are interested in that. Great. There's so much to talk about, but we've got to move on to our next paper. So I'm going to hand it over to Braden to talk to us about dexamethasone.
Thank you. So I'm going to present a paper from the Journal of Pain and Symptom Management. It was published in January of this year, and it's titled Impact of Dosing and Duration of Dexamethasone on Serious Corticosteroid-Related Adverse Events. So just going through some of the key points from this article, as we know, corticosteroids are widely used both in oncology as well as within palliative care. We use them all the time for symptom management. Despite this, we really have a bit of a lack of evidence in terms of what is the optimal dose of these medications as well as duration, and risks of adverse effects is often lacking, especially within the context of our population. So many of the side effects we often look at with corticosteroids are related to non-cancer patients and prolonged use, so maybe not as relevant when you're looking at a life-limiting illness and the doses that we may use in our patients as well. So this study was a secondary analysis looking at the effects of dexamethasone on dyspnea in cancer patients. So the name of that initial trial was the ABCD trial, which stood for Alleviating Breathlessness in Cancer Patients with Dexamethasone. So the primary outcome of this paper was looking at grade 3+ adverse effects. And then other things they looked at were secondary outcomes, including any grade adverse event that occurred, as well as what were the most common adverse events as well. So going through the methods that were used in the overall study design and some of those key details, So looking at the original ABCD trial, which they then performed the secondary analysis on for this paper, in that initial trial, patients were randomized in a 2-to-1 ratio to receive dexamethasone 8 milligrams by mouth twice daily for 1 week, followed by 4 milligrams twice daily for 7 days, or they were given a matching placebo. So it was either that whole course of steroids, so a 14-day course, or it was matching placebo for 14 days in a 2-to-1 ratio. Patients then, after that point, could decide if they wanted to partake in an open label phase of the study. So if they chose to continue, they would get a 4 milligrams of dexamethasone twice a day for another 7 days, followed by 2 milligrams a day twice daily for an additional week, and then they would stop the steroid. So throughout this entire process, there was weekly assessments to determine adherence and response to the steroid, as well as recording any adverse events that occurred. Up to 6 weeks of follow-up occurred. In terms of the study population, this was from MD Anderson Cancer Center, as well as Lyndon B. Johnson Hospital General Oncology Clinic. So that's in Houston, Texas. And it occurred between January 2017 and April 2021. So within this study, patients were divided into four groups based on their total dexamethasone exposure. So there was kind of a graded exposure depending on the group, which was sort of helpful in terms of analysis and seeing dose-related adverse events. So in group A, these had the highest exposure over 4 weeks, which was an average of 256 milligrams. Group B had an average of 168 milligrams over 2 weeks. Group C, average of 88 milligrams over 2 weeks. And then there was the placebo group who had no exposure. So those were the patients in the original trial who were randomized to placebo. And then in the open phase of the study, they chose not to continue on steroids. So they got no exposure at all. And they were sort of used as a control group then. They used multivariable logistic regression modeling to find significant difference in the frequency of adverse events between the groups. So going through the findings, this is a little bit of a wordy graph here, but we'll kind of break it down. There was 119 patients total. So then there was those four groups, as mentioned, with group A having 32 patients. Those had the most dexamethasone exposure over the study timeframe. 47 patients in group B, 20 in group C, and 20 in group D. And group D was that placebo group with no steroid exposure at all. When they looked at the results, out of the 119 patients total, 99 of them, so 83%, had any grade adverse event. 38 of 119, so 32% of patients, had grade 3 adverse events, which was one of the primary outcomes they were looking at. And then 23% of patients required hospitalization. When they looked at kind of how frequent those more severe adverse events occurred, so the grade 3 plus, they occurred in 65% of patients in group A, so with the highest exposure to steroid, versus 25% of patients in group B, 15% in group C, and then 15% in group D. Of note, when grade 1 or 2 adverse events occurred, so sort of deemed more mild adverse events, those tended to occur within the first couple of weeks of steroid exposure, whereas the more severe adverse events, so grade 3 plus or hospitalizations, those had a bit of a later onset. So the median onset was 20 days for grade 3 plus adverse events and 26 days for hospitalization. So kind of a bit of a delayed term of in terms of looking at the steroid dose and when you might see those effects. It was later than the more mild side effects. Statistically significant differences among treatment groups having grade 3 plus adverse events, hospitalization, and insomnia. And something they noted in the article was that group A had an odds ratio of 15.1 in experiencing grade 3 adverse events compared to no exposure to steroid at all. Now that had a pretty wide confidence interval because it's a fairly low number of patients. So the range there was 1.4 to 160, but it worked out to a 15.1 odds ratio. Grade 3 plus adverse events occurred a median of 20 days, as I stated, after exposure. And they did note as well that there was a high rate of infection in the highest exposure group, so group A, and that was 29% of patients, although because of the low number of patients in the trial, it wasn't statistically significant. And they also noted that neuropsychiatric symptoms, which can be things like delirium, depression, restlessness, psychosis, those occurred a median of 10 days after exposure. And there was a higher incidence with increased doses of steroid and longer duration of use. And the last point here is that insomnia occurred in 31% of patients with a median onset of only 7 days. And that's despite this trial counseling patients to take their latest dose of steroid by 2 o'clock in the afternoon. There were still high rates of insomnia. So some key discussion points from this article: the most common adverse events included insomnia, dyspepsia, neuropsychiatric symptoms, as I previously mentioned, as well as infection. And the higher incidence of adverse events in this trial compared to others. So they kind of found higher numbers throughout. And they thought this could be due to higher doses of the steroids that were used compared to other trials that have been done before, as well as longer duration. And they did have quite a long period of follow-up for up to 6 weeks as well. So some studies were more limited and only had a few weeks of follow-up. This had 6 weeks. And they had really vigilant, kind of rigorous monitoring as well with very common side effects. There might have been high reporting rates compared to other trials as well. One important point to consider is that this population, because of the original study being on effective steroids for dyspnea, that the baseline population all had dyspnea, at least moderate severity. And so they may have had other comorbid conditions compared to different studies looking at steroid use. One discussion point was that as prescribers, we should be cautious when we're using doses of greater than 8 milligrams a day of dexamethasone, as they definitely noted some significant risk of serious adverse events or hospitalization. So in terms of some additional comments or points from the article, it is difficult to draw firm conclusions when it comes to the dosing as well as the length of steroid use. But I thought it was a helpful study in terms of highlighting the importance of really reassessing our use of steroids frequently and using the lowest dose possible for the shortest duration as well. So I find it's one of those medications that can sort of be started and then something in the background you're not always reassessing or thinking about. So it really just, for me, highlighted the importance of considering always reassessing and does the patient truly need this medication. I thought that research looking at effects of frequent pulse dosing might be helpful. So, for example, maybe there's a particular time frame of being off dexamethasone or other steroids that your risk of adverse events will sort of return close to baseline. But this study didn't look at pulse dosing. It was sort of prolonged dosing of steroids. In terms of study strengths, this was a double-blinded RCT, which is great. It looked at steroid side effects in the context of advanced cancer, which is quite relevant to our patients that we see. And it was nice as well that it had the four groups with different exposures to steroid, including a placebo group that had no exposure at all. Some limitations of this study, that it was a relatively small sample size with 119 patients. It was limited to the outpatient setting, so maybe not as generalizable to inpatient unit. And it had, although pretty good follow-up of 42 days, there still could be things that were missed with only that 6 weeks of follow-up. Another limitation that I sort of thought as I read through this was the inclusion of that open label phase of the study, where patients would have that choice of if they want to continue on the steroid or not. You know, it's possible that the patients who had increased disease or symptom burden may have been the ones who kind of self-selected to continue the steroid versus not. And maybe those same patients could be at higher risk of adverse events from being on the steroid. In addition, the study was only from one site in Texas, so hard to know if it's completely generalizable to the broader patient population. And lastly, why is this article important? As we all know, we use steroids very frequently with a variety of indications, often in sort of an acute crisis, and then we look to lower the dose over time and come off of that medication. There was limited research in terms of side effects that's really relevant to palliative care. And this study showed that there are risks of high dose and prolonged dexamethasone. And I think that this info could help kind of guide informed decision-making with patients when we're looking at risk-benefit of our medications.
Great. Thanks so much, Braden. I'm wondering if you could clarify something in the study design methodology for Valerie. So she has just put a question that she's confused about the dosing times, because in the article and on the slide, it said that the dosing was every 12 hours, but no dose was given past 2 p.m. Because of insomnia or potential to interfere with sleep. So she's just curious if that means they were getting dosed at 2 in the morning and 2 in the afternoon. Do you see anything in the paper that clarified that? Mm.
Good point. That may have been a bit of an error with my slide here. I just opened up the original study, and it looks like actually they mentioned in the initial methodology, I apologize, because it looks like it was BID, and I put it as Q12H in my slides. So that's a good pickup there. It looks like it was a BID dosing, not a Q12H dosing.
Yeah. Actually, I see under methods, it is every 12 hours. So I think the error is on their part.
Exactly.
Oh, yes. Okay, yeah. Well, then I'll blame them. Okay.
Yeah, I suspect it was exactly meant to be BID. And then she wanted to know if there's any data on how the patients felt as far as their dyspnea, which is probably the first publication, but whether dyspnea was improved and whether it was worth the experience of side effects.
Yeah, that's a good question. Because this study was looking at that secondary analysis. To be honest, I didn't look back at the original to see kind of what the effects were on dyspnea. But that would be something good to look at to sort of weigh, like, what is the benefit or what's the trade-off? So yeah, that's something I intend to look at in the future for sure.
Great. Sharon, did you want to add any comments? And then I'll go to our last question.
Actually, I was going to bring up the PPI question.
Perfect.
Because, which I see that Jeremy had put in the question and answer box. Yes. So I was interested to see that dyspepsia was one of the more frequent adverse events. And the authors, I think, did say that there's insufficient evidence at this point to recommend that PPIs be used routinely, but it's something definitely worth considering, especially in those patients who may have pre-existing upper GI issues.
Yeah. And Braden, did they comment on GI bleed? I thought it was just dyspepsia, just to clarify that.
Yeah. And I think there was a note in the article stating that no patients had any sort of severe GI bleed. That would have been something they were monitoring for, but no patients had that outcome, as far as I recall. So yeah, that's why it wasn't really discussed more. And then there was the note, sorry, you cut out, my internet connection was a little unstable there for a second. But yeah, in terms of PPI, I think they said that there's other studies showing that there's not really evidence in the outpatient ambulatory setting of giving routine prophylaxis with PPI in terms of GI bleed risk, but that in the inpatient setting, they stated in the paper that there is evidence of giving PPI.
Great.
And so I don't know if that's a repeat from what you said. You cut out for a second there. So
no worries. Okay. Thanks. Great. Well, we're going to move on to our last article. So machine learning, over to you, Sharon.
Yes. So this comes from our palliative care colleagues in Ontario. And so the premise for the study is that this audience is probably aware that research has shown that early specialist palliative care consultation for patients with advanced cancer has multiple benefits. And some organizations such as American Society of Clinical Oncology have advocated for routine consultation within 8 weeks of diagnosis of advanced disease. However, concern has been expressed that there are a limited number of palliative care specialists, and so it may make more sense to adopt a more targeted approach to consultation. So machine learning is a subfield of artificial intelligence where a machine imitates intelligent human behavior. So these authors wanted to apply that technology to clinical decision making, and specifically to see if a machine learning system could help to identify those patients who would die within a year and therefore be appropriate for a specialist palliative care consultation. And they wanted to look at the impact on the timing of consultation and on the number of consultations. So they looked at administrative health databases in Ontario, and the population were those patients who were on palliative intense systemic therapy between June 2014 and December 2019. There were some significant exclusions. For example, no patients with hematological disease, no patients on clinical trial, no patients on hormone therapy, no patients on oral systemic therapy, because it was more difficult to capture that in the available databases. And they divided that population into a development cohort on which they developed their learning machine learning system, and then a test cohort. And they used July 2017 as the cutoff. So anyone who had their first treatment before July 2017 was in the development cohort. Everyone who had their treatment afterwards was in the test cohort. And so what they did was they fed in their development cohort, they fed this machine learning system some data. So they fed in demographics, acute care use, cancer diagnosis and treatment, symptoms, functional status, and lab values. And so they told this machine, so develop a system to identify patients who are going to die within a year after their first treatment. And so they looked at different iterations of this model and they chose one. And then they tested it in their other cohort, their test cohort, to see how did this model actually perform and how did it do compared to what actually happened in terms of timing and number of consultations. And in this study, any palliative care consult that happened more than 6 months before death was considered as early. And those that occurred more than 2 years before death, they considered as too early. So they included 54,000 patients, and they found that this machine learning system did a good job of predicting who is going to die within a year. And then they looked at, so what in that test cohort, so what actually happened in terms of timing of the specialist palliative care consultation. So what they found was that only 15% of patients in that test cohort actually got their consultation more than 6 months before death, and 12% had it more than 2 years before death. So then they looked, what would have happened if they had implemented this machine learning system? And they saw that the number of patients who had that early specialist palliative care increased by 8.5%. So a total of 23% of that population had that early consultation. And for those who got it too early, that increased by only 2.1%. And the other finding was that when they looked at the total number of consultations to palliative care, the total number did not increase with the implementation of machine learning system. They just were found earlier. So the discussion was that the performance of this system, what's novel is that they're looking at an entire population in Ontario, and they acknowledged that this was a prognostic-based system. They didn't look at other triggers for palliative care consultation. They did warn that with machine learning, there's always a risk of introducing bias if the data that the machine is learning to develop their model is, if that data is biased, and that bias will come through in their model. And they advocate for implementing and evaluating these sort of machine learning prognostic systems in identifying patients for specialist palliative care. So strengths, population-based, methodologically rigorous, limitations, there are key exclusions in their patient population. They don't look at other triggers for specialist palliative care, such as high symptom burden. Although the total amount of consultations did not increase, they didn't account for follow-ups. So if you see a patient earlier, you're going to probably need to do more follow-up visits, and it does have to be validated. So I guess for me, the main takeaway is that one of our fears as specialist palliative care consultants is that by implementing systematic referrals that will overwhelm us. And this, in terms of volume of referrals, and this study suggests that that might not be the case. However, further research and validation is needed before we draw that conclusion.
Thanks, Sharon. Again, like lots we could talk about in this article, and we are short on time, but I think I was most surprised by that last finding as well, that it didn't increase the overall number of consults. So I think there's definitely more work to be done to understand how to best apply machine learning and AI in palliative care in terms of identification of patients and what that means for both generalist and specialist level palliative care. Braden, would you like to make any quick comments, and then we'll move on to the honorable mentions out of the interest of time?
Not too much. I mean, I think that's just like such a unique area that's kind of coming to light lately, and wondering how we're going to navigate AI in general. But yeah, if there's ways to implement it to get kind of more appropriate consults early on, I think that's really a positive thing. And yeah, I agree. That's interesting that the total number of consults didn't actually go up. But maybe just kind of more appropriate. But yeah, the importance, like you said, of like the ongoing follow-up and what would that actually look like long-term. But I just thought it's a really quite a unique article. So thank you for sharing.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing how this evolves, because I think there is going to be a bigger place for machine learning in many of our practices. So making sure we do it in the right way, I guess, right? So yeah, thanks so much for presenting that. So we had three other papers that we wanted you to take a look at that would be of interest and would really help us improve the way we think about palliative care. You'll see them here on the slide. The first one is an article looking at the influence of the oral microbiome on patterns of oral mucositis in terms of the severity in patients with squamous cell carcinoma of the head and neck. The second one is looking at improving access for palliative care for people experiencing socioeconomic inequities, findings from a community-based pilot research study. And then the third one is looking at a default palliative care consultation for seriously ill hospitalized patients, pragmatic cluster randomized control trials. So you can get those references through our Journal Watch website. And in conclusion, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you all for joining us for today's Journal Watch session, and to both Sharon and Braden for their work to present today. Thank you again, and we look forward to seeing you at our next session. And a big shout out to all of our Journal Watch contributors across all of the universities you can see here. We couldn't do it without this amazing team. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. I'm James O'Hearn, and I hope you found it both enjoyable and informative. If you'd like to learn more about the Journal Watch program or our other palliative care ECHO project activities, feel free to email us at echo@pallium.ca. That's echo@pallium.ca. Or visit our website at www.echopalliative.com. The music for this episode is Dazed by Airtone. Copyright 2012, licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial 3.0 license. You can find Airtone's music at dig.ccmixter.org. Today's episode was produced by Diana Vince. See you soon!